This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Less soot, less smog. What could be wrong with that? The costs, say industry groups and governors opposed to the EPA's new proposal to further limit air pollution, based on the fact, they say, that this science does not support the proposed changes. This hour, we'll be talking about the science behind the EPA's proposed regulations, just how harmful are smog and soot, and how much difference would the new standards make, and what about the costs? Is it worth it? And what effect will these regulations have on individual states? Cleaning the air in the Midwest, for example, might help people in the East breathe easier, but it may cost those states out West a lot more than it will for states in the East. We'll talk about that. We'll also be talking about the politics of pollution control, how Congress, if it really wants to, could override these recommendations, but does it want to enough? What do you think? Give us a call, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you have access to America Online, you can join a live discussion about the program. Just search on the keyword NPR and then click on the control room when you find it. Now let me introduce my guests. Carol Browner is the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington, and she joins us in our NPR studios. Welcome back to Science Friday.
It's great to be here, Ira.
Thank you. Paul Heward is the Senior Vice President for Policy and Communications at the National Association of Manufacturers in Washington. He's also at our NPR studios. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. David Barron is a science reporter for NPR, and he's been covering the EPA's proposed air standards, and he joins us from WBUR in Boston. Thanks for joining us, David.
Hi, Ira.
Let me ask you, Carol Browner, first, why do we need changes? Doesn't that imply that the air that we're breathing now is unhealthy? What has happened?
The Clean Air Act, as put forward by Congress, requires EPA to at least every 5 years review the current scientific data and determine whether or not air pollution standards are adequate to protect the public's health. And that's exactly what we've done here. We've complied with the congressional requirement, which was reaffirmed when President Bush led the effort to strengthen and rewrite the Clean Air Act not too long ago.
Does that mean that the old standards that we're working under now are not healthy standards for us?
It's important to understand that we've made a lot of progress in this country in terms of cleaning up our air, but the job is not done. And what the science shows us now is that far too many people, particularly our children, are at risk. What these studies found, what the peer-reviewed science showed us, is more than 20,000 premature deaths a year, aggravated asthma in 250,000 individuals. Asthma is now the single largest cause of hospital admissions for children in this country. We've seen a 118% increase in asthma between the years 1980 and 1993. Mm-hmm. And the science is saying to us that the current standards, while certainly what the science led us to conclude 10, 15 years ago, it is not what the science today leads us to conclude.
Mm-hmm. And we're basically talking about here in these standards two main pollutants, ozone and particles, tiny little particles.
That's correct. What we're talking about, and the way many people would think about this, is soot, or these fine particles which become embedded in the lungs and can result in premature death, or smog, those things that we all are familiar with here in the nation's capital. We still have alert days when literally we have to say to our children, we have to say to our senior citizens, oops, don't go outside. The air is not healthy. You can't breathe the air.
Now, many states in many counties in the country can't even meet the current standards. How are they going to meet the newer, more strict standards?
Well, the law is very clear in requiring EPA to first look at the public health considerations, and that's what we're doing here. What we're saying to the public is we looked at the current health effects data, and what it showed us and what the scientific community concluded is that the current levels of pollution have real effects on large numbers of people in this country. Everything we're doing today is important in terms of further reducing air pollution, and as we conclude the public comment period, as we reach a final decision on what are the appropriate standards for the future, we can build on the steps we are currently taking. We can put in place some of the new programs that EPA has developed over the last several years to further reduce the air pollution so that all of the people in this country have clean, healthy air to breathe.
Mm-hmm. Paul Heward, as a senior vice president at the National Association of Manufacturers, and I'm sure that you take issue with these new standards, as other people in business and industry do. Do you think they're not justified? They impose too harsh a penalty on business and businesses and factories?
Well, what we think is that the government, in this case the Environmental Protection Agency, is moving too fast and on the basis of evidence, while it may be the best available, in our judgment, is still not good enough. There are too many leaps of faith and stretches based in the statistics to justify what is going to be an extremely costly regulation. So that we think that while it is incumbent upon the agency to adhere to the congressional mandate and review these standards every 5 years, it is clear from executive orders that apply to this agency that one of their options is not to regulate any further. And we think that that's what they should have done in this case, because frankly, the scientific evidence available, particularly in the case of particulates, is highly controversial and ambiguous and can be read any number of ways. And in our judgment, the probability that the conclusion the agency has jumped to is correct is probably well under 50%.
David Barron is someone who has studied the science of this. Let's talk about that. What is when Paul Heward talks about ambiguity? What is the ambiguity he's talking about in the science here?
Well, there definitely is some ambiguity in terms of what the particulate data show. But I have to say that the evidence is very strong that something is going on. And it's important to separate the ozone and the particulate standards, because the science is different for the two, and the harm that's being done to people by those pollutants is different. But if we're looking at the particulates, there's a tremendous amount of research that's been done in the last few years in many, many cities, in Philadelphia, in Birmingham, Alabama, in Steubenville, Ohio, in Watertown, Massachusetts, in Provo, Utah. Across the country, and in fact around the world, studies have been done that show that when particle levels are high in the atmosphere, the number of people being admitted to hospitals, the number of people dying, goes up. That has been shown time and time again. Now, that's a statistical association. When particle levels are high in the atmosphere, often other pollutants are also high in the atmosphere. And so industry's argument tends to be, well, we don't really know that it's the particles that are causing people to die. However, the weight of evidence, because even in some areas where the particles are high and other pollutants aren't, you see the same thing. The evidence is very suggestive. There is, of course, another unknown, and that is which type of particle is causing the harm. Particulates are made up of many, many different things, of road dust and sea salt that gets into the air, as well as tiny acid particles that come from smokestacks and soot from diesel buses. It's possible that some of these particles are harmful and others aren't, and it's possible that the new EPA regulation, if it's promulgated, will cause a clampdown on some types of particles that don't cause that much harm. So there are certainly scientific unknowns, but even some staunch industry scientists that I've talked to who are skeptical will admit to me that something in the air is killing people. They're not convinced it's the particles, but something is.
Carol Browner, isn't the thinking that the particles that we once thought were not so harmful, the tiny, teeny little bits of soot, now may be more harmful than because they get into places that smaller places that other particles could not get in there?
That's exactly right. What the science has shown us is that it's the teeny tiny, the 2.5 microns in diameter particles that are causing these dramatic health effects. And as David pointed out, depending on which studies you look at, that may be as many as 40,000 premature deaths per year. You know, I think it's important to understand the science that EPA did here. It is unlike almost anything we've done in the history of the agency. We have been investigating the science for more than 3 years in both instances, both the fine particles and the ozone. This is all peer-reviewed science. It is peer review of peer review of peer review, quite frankly. We had industry, we had university representatives, we had a scientific peer review panel, not scientists who work for EPA, scientists outside of EPA, who looked at this and in both instances concluded that the current standards leave too many people in this country at risk for respiratory illness, premature death, aggravated asthma. And so what EPA has now done is taken that and said to the American people in a proposal, we believe that the standards should be strengthened. Here is where we would draw the line, and here is who will be protected and from what health effects. Now you, the American people, you tell us if you think those are the right people to protect. You tell us, mothers, fathers, children, pediatricians, our seniors, you tell us if we're drawing the right line.
But my question is, if these are tiny particles, do you know the origin of where these tiny particles come from?
In many instances, we do.
Where would they be?
From certain industrial types of facilities. David mentioned buses, diesel engines. We are aware of where many of these particles are coming from. And we're also aware of what kind of cost-effective steps we can take to reduce the pollution. When we look at the areas where the air may not be able to meet a tougher standard, what we find is that approximately 70% of those communities, those areas, could meet a better public health standard through currently available or about to be available technologies on the books.
And they don't because why?
Well, they currently aren't putting in place some of these available technologies because they don't have to, quite frankly, because the standards that are on the books today, they're able to meet. Some of these requirements will play out over the next several years. Industry will be continuing to reduce their pollution, and that will help to serve us in providing cleaner air and, if we conclude with tougher standards, to meet those tougher public health standards.
Well, how do you enforce this? Some of these states are not meeting the current standards. How are they going to meet the more strict standards?
Well, I think it's important to understand that every state that is required to develop a plan for meeting public health air standards has, in fact, done that. And even places like Los Angeles, where obviously their air pollution problems are far worse than most regions in the country, they have a plan now that will bring them into compliance with public health air standards. They've done it. They figured out how to reduce their pollution, and they are doing that. Now, they still have some work to conclude, but they know what the steps are. And so to suggest that somehow or another there's not an answer here, I really think is a disservice to those in industry who have a long history, a long record of saying, give me a challenge and I will rise to the occasion. Mm-hmm. You know, Ira, when this country made the decision 8 or 9 years ago to get rid of chlorofluorocarbons, CFCs, because of the public health effects and what it was doing to the upper ozone level, there were some in industry who said, oh my God, the world as we know it will come to the end and people will be forced to drive their cars without air conditioning. There were others in industry who said, okay, we accept the public health data. Let us work in partnership with EPA to find a replacement. And today, not only have we found that replacement, we did it in record time, and people still have air conditioning in their cars. Mm-hmm.
Paul Heward, what is the industry going to do now about these standards? Are they going to try to comply with them or try to fight them in Congress?
Well, there's nothing to comply with yet. What we have is a proposal.
Right.
We will attempt to dissuade the government from implementing its proposal, largely on the basis of the fact that the scientific evidence is nowhere near as compelling as they claim it is. One of the things I'm encumbered with is an undergraduate degree in statistics, and frankly,
we won't hold that against you.
What they've done is they've piled assumption upon assumption upon assumption. And while it's true they have a large weight of evidence, a lot of it is basically interpolated. For instance, there are several hundred studies that they used. A handful of those studies, single-digit number, actually directly measured particulate matter at the 2.5 level. The other 190-odd studies measured it at a much grosser level, either PM10 or one of the earlier precursor levels, and they are interpolating based on assumptions of linear ratios and assuming that they can make correct interpolations for the effect of PM2.5. Well, you know, that's essentially nonsense, particularly when the relatively few monitoring areas on which they develop their ratios, where they have monitors that measure both PM10 and PM2.5, are located in wilderness areas and national parks, and they're interpolating these numbers to urban areas and cities. Well, That in itself is a leap of faith I'm not willing to take at the cost that's likely to be imposed by these regulations. What they need to do is reverse the sequence here. They're having the verdict first and they're going to have the trial later. What they need to do is have the trial first and the verdict later. So we will fight these regulations, and if we're unsuccessful in persuading the agency to maintain the existing standards while they develop better science and better data, we'll fight it in the Congress.
Mm-hmm. And Ira, if I could just make a point here. It really does come down to some extent to a value judgment. Mr. Heward is certainly right. The science is not yet watertight. The question is, what do we do as a society with very suggestive evidence that isn't yet definite? And I know people within the EPA who make a point, which I think makes some sense, that perhaps what we should do is put in place stricter standards now, knowing that, in fact, the EPA has to, within 5 years, reevaluate the standard again. This proposed standard, if it's implemented, no one's going to have to actually meet the standard until well into the next decade, which means there will be another evaluation by the year 2001, mm-hmm. 2002. And if, in fact, EPA has overstepped its bounds, then the standard could be loosened again. So what do we do in the meantime is the question.
Ira, if I might say something about the science in the case of the fine particles. The science that EPA looked at, the science that our external scientific peer review panel looked at, included literally hundreds of studies, but there were 86 that they specifically focused on, which were the human health studies. 25 are epidemiological studies that showed increased mortality. 20 are epidemiological studies that showed increased hospital admissions. 21 studies showed increased coughing chest pain. 8 studies showed increased coughing chest pain. I mean, this is not a few studies. This is the work of some of the leading scientists in this country, all of which has been subjected to peer review, published in scientific journals, and involves literally hundreds of thousands of individuals. EPA, I think, deserves a lot of credit for the leadership it has provided over the last 25 years and the work it has done in partnership with communities, with industries, with state, local government to address real pollution problems. The quality of the science we have in this particular instance is far greater than the science we had available to us 10, 15 years ago when we were making some very important decisions, like the decision to ban lead in gasoline and protect our children.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Ken. And is it Langlotz?
That's right.
And Portland, Oregon. Hi, Ken.
Well, I'm with the National Motorists Association. We're a citizens group of tens of thousands nationwide, not associated with industry. And I wanted to make the important point that it's not just industry that thinks that this EPA program is going way too far. It's from everything I've seen, we're looking at major substantial costs for minuscule and uncertain health benefits. And anytime a government agency or an industry puts together a plan like this, they do a cost-benefit analysis. And they say, well, what's the approximate cost of whether it's the deaths or increased coughing or something like that? And they weigh that against what's the cost to society.
Well, what cost are you worried about here?
I'm worried about the cost that when you have billions of dollars sucking into a pointless and uncertain health benefit that could have gone either to stay with citizens, which is a proven economic benefit, or more productive use in the economy. It's just a drain on the economy that provides no benefit, or a minimal benefit, and could provide a much greater benefit by leaving the money where it is instead of forcing industry to comply with regulation.
As a member of the National Motorist Association, would you also be concerned with the added cost of gasoline or motor oil being driven up by pollution controls?
Absolutely. If you take a poor family who has to spend more money on a more expensive gasoline and has less money for health care, there you've got a real health effect. And there are economic studies that show that for every dollar you take away from a citizen, you have this certain amount of health effect.
If the science, in your opinion, if the science were more exact, would you then be supportive of such a move?
Well, if we saw reasonable numbers and weren't hearing kind of these worst-case scenarios that something can cause death or it's as many as a certain number of deaths, which is what we hear from the EPA, if we were hearing the best guess numbers, and if we heard that this increased coughing was associated with a total economic health cost to society of a certain amount, and you know, if we were going to prevent $1 million worth of these health costs and it's going to cost $100 million to do it, I would say let's not do it. Mm-hmm. But if the EPA is willing to give us honest numbers and middle-of-the-road numbers, not exaggerated to the top of every confidence band.
All right, let me get a reaction from Carol Browner.
All right, if I might just explain to Ken that, in fact, we have done an analysis looking at what the cost would be in terms of reducing air pollution and what the benefits would be. Mm-hmm. And what we found is that the cost taken out over a lengthy amount of time, because that's the time that will be available to industry to make the adjustments, would average approximately $6 to $8 billion a year. The benefits in terms of hospital emissions down, deaths avoided, medical treatments avoided, reduced lost work days, are between $50 and $112 billion. Clearly, the benefits far outweigh the cost here. And there's a long history under the Clean Air Act of that being exactly the case. Today, the benefits that flow to the American people in terms of their health associated with the steps we have taken under the Clean Air Act are 40 times the cost associated with reducing air pollution.
Well, let me go.
Might I ask if this study is available for the public to see?
It is absolutely available. We have published it in the Federal Register. We are making things available through the internet. And we are asking the American people to help us in this decision. And they can do so through a number of ways, including 1-888-TEL-EPA. We want to hear from the public. We recognize that this is a significant decision. That's why we're in a comment period. Mm-hmm. That's why no final decision is made. We want to hear from the American people about who to protect against what.
We're talking about clean air this hour on Talk of the Nation from National Public Radio. Paul Heward, if this is true, if there are huge cost savings here, wouldn't it be to the benefit of industry to get behind this? Because, you know, as a manufacturer, as an employer, some of the biggest bills you're paying is for the health care of your employees. And if you can lower the health care bills that you're shelling out, wouldn't that be to your advantage?
Well, it would. What we are totally unpersuaded by, which is why I asked the administrator if we could see the study, is the accuracy and adequacy of those numbers. I mean, if there are persuasive numbers saying that for a cost of $8 billion you can save 100 or 50 for that matter, we certainly would entertain a more favorable view of this proposal. Our concern is that the savings, the 50 to 100 billion in savings, are probably based on what we regard as the exaggerated number of deaths that are going to be prevented. Again, question the significant weight of the EPA's scientific evidence. What we question is the quality. Basically, as I pointed out, very few of these studies were based on actual study of particulate 2.5 matter. Unlike other pollutants controlled under the Clean Air Act, which are basically single chemicals like NOx or carbon monoxide, particulate matter has four or five distinct components, and there may be 86 studies which suggested a statistical correlation, and there is a vast difference between a statistical correlation and a provable, documentable cause-and-effect relationship.
You want to nail down the particle size and the disease, basically. X size
like
particle,
to,
X disease, if that's...
Well,
if,
or, what we think the problem here is that... the current proposal involves piling too many assumptions on too many assumptions. It assumes that you can interpolate data from, you know, a PM10 or grosser level down to a PM2.5 level. It assumes that statistical correlation equates pretty closely with cause and effect, which is not demonstrable. It assumes that by regulating particulate matter, you're regulating the right thing, and it may be only one of those four or five basic elements of particulate matter that's causing most of the problem. You've assumed that you're adequately controlling for other variables. For instance, you're assuming that these studies adequately factor out the fact that when 500 people die in Chicago, in the course of a week when the temperature exceeds 103 degrees for five straight days that it had any remote relationship to particulate matter as opposed to heat prostration. That is a very large assumption. And when you pile assumption on assumption on assumption, what happens is, to justify this standard, all of your assumptions have to be right. Well, if each one of them has an 80% probability of right, but there's three of them in a row that have to be right, you're well under 50% in terms of probability right there.
Okay, well, quick reaction, Carol Browner. I have 30 seconds before I have to take a break.
I think the real question for industry to answer is, does the science show that the American public is currently adequately protected? We believe the science shows they are not protected, and that is why we are proposing to strengthen the standards. I'd be interested to hear from industry. Do they think the current standards are protecting the American people?
Well, we certainly don't know that they're not. Frankly, the air gets cleaner and cleaner under the 1990 amendments and under the PM10
standards.
Well,
what about the ozone?
We don't know what it is about particulate matter that's going to protect the public. For instance, it may turn out that the stringent standard is irrelevant because it's nanoparticles.
We know asthma is increasing and that too many children in this country suffer from aggravated asthma, and that is not appropriate.
We have another whole half hour to go on debating this, and I'm going to tell everybody to take a drink of water. We'll come back and continue after this short break. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Jillian in Westlake, Ohio. Hi, Jillian.
Hi, Ira. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Got a question for us?
Well, I got a question about the actual proposal, and I have a comment about the science and the law.
Okay.
I guess I'll do the comment about the science and the law first. If we wait for conclusive evidence about anything, in terms of the scientific realm, we're going to be waiting an awfully long time because our science keeps getting more and more. We never find the end of anything.
It's hard to pin down that last 5%.
And if we're going to wait for perfect waterproof conclusions, we're never going to have them because there's always more science being done.
Well, let me ask you this question. Are you willing to pay more,
even though
you're not sure if it's worth it?
You bet.
You are.
Yes, I am.
I think most people are. I think that's what Congress worries
about. A lot of people are because people are paying for their sick children. People are paying for their sick elderly. People are paying every time they turn around. Mm-hmm. I think if they could pay on the preventative end, they'd rather pay there than to see their family suffer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that on this vein, we're talking about law and science, that if we can, in this country, make it so that people, individuals, are not allowed to smoke because it's not in the public interest, in the hallways of their apartment buildings, in their offices, and they have to go outside, it changes that whole structure of the way business has been done and people have socialized. If we can expect that of individuals, why can't we expect that of industry?
Mm-hmm.
When are we going to start putting people, and that includes those industry people's children and parents and siblings and everybody else, ahead of corporate profits and money?
Let me go to part one of your question.
Oh, well, that was just my comment. My question is this. This is about the proposal.
Okay.
I have heard that there are things pertaining to the use of wood stoves in this proposal. Whether that is true or not, I do not know.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm if I might just respond, this is Carol Browner. It's not true. You know, what some in industry are trying to do is scare the American people. Rather than allowing the American people to evaluate the EPA proposal to comment on it, they're suggesting that their wood stoves are going to be taken away, their lawnmowers are going to be taken away, their fishing boats are going to be mm-hmm. taken away. What EPA is doing at this point in time is presenting the science to the American people, telling the American people, based on our judgment, where we think the standards fail to provide enough protection and how they should be strengthened, and asking the American people whether or not they agree.
And let me ask you then this. Are there standards being set for things like, or is it proposed for standards to be set for things like lawn mowers and outboard motors and chainsaws and snowmobiles and the like?
Well, this is actually a great example of how EPA and industry can work in partnership. We had a program with the lawnmower manufacturers over the last several years to design a cleaner, small engine. Highly successful program. We worked in partnership, a collegial effort. And today, you can, in fact, go down to your local hardware store and buy a much cleaner lawnmower, thanks to EPA and thanks to the industry partnership. That's what we want to do again. We want to work together. As I said before, a approximately 70% of the areas that might be affected would be able to meet a tougher public health standard based on currently available technology.
I agree. I agree with you 100%. I'm not in any kind of industry that you're discussing, but I do a lot of reading. And there's things on the shelf in a lot of places that could be used right now. And I think if part of what you're proposing is more of this kind of a joint effort between the EPA and industry to not just, I'm not talking just about the factories and those things, but those small appliances that people don't think add up to a lot that really do, I think that's a good way to go. I think EPA ought to be working with these people. And that has my support. Was that number 1-800-TEL-EPA?
It's a toll-free number, and because there are too many 800 numbers now in the country, it is 1-888-TEL-EPA.
And can individuals get a copy of the proposal?
Certainly, you can call and request a copy. You can also get one through the Internet.
Okay, well, I'm not online, so I'm a bit of a Luddite.
Thanks for calling, Jillian.
Thank you, Ira, and
bye-bye.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Ira, this is David Barron.
Go ahead.
If I could just make a comment on what Jillian and Carol Browner were both saying. I think it's true, and Carol Browner, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that these new standards, if they are promulgated, could in fact mean restrictions on the use of wood stoves or the type of wood stoves, could mean restrictions on lawnmowers in some areas, could mean restrictions on backyard barbecues. That doesn't mean we're going to see that in a lot of the United States, but we could see that depending on how individual states decide to meet these standards if they go into force.
Quite frankly, that is not what EPA has in mind under any scenario. David is right that once a public health standard is set under the Clean Air Act, then individual states, individual areas within a state develop the mechanisms for reducing the pollution in conjunction with EPA's work with industry to lower their pollution. And what we've done over the last 4 years is provide a great deal of flexibility to cities, to communities, to come up with a common sense, cost-effective plan for their community. And we haven't seen people banning outdoor barbecues or banning lawnmowers. We believe that the cleaner engines, the small engines we've been able to develop, the work we've done with Summit Industry to already begin the process of reducing their pollution, the work we've done with the diesel engine manufacturers to design a cleaner engine, the work we've done with Detroit so that beginning in model year 1998, there'll be a little inexpensive device inside your car. You won't even know about it. It's called the onboard canister. Goes a long way towards reducing air pollution and cleaning up the air you breathe.
So I think a lot of people are wondering, you know, is it next year if this goes through that I give up my barbecue? Or you're talking about way ahead, years in advance, where you can gradually allow technology to catch up to clean up some of these things.
We're not talking about giving up anyone's barbecue. You know, when I hear these stories, I'm again reminded of the CFCs and what some in industry told us, that we'd be giving up our automobiles with air conditioning. Every single person I know who wants a car with air conditioning has it today, and yet we got rid of CFCs, and we're experiencing the health benefits of having done just that.
All right, let's go.
If I could make a comment on the prior caller as to why industry opposes this, and it's a two-part comment. The first relates to, I believe, Jillian's observation that we shouldn't worry about cutting into corporate profits to provide these benefits.
She said she's willing to pay more for it.
Right, and she will, because I can assure you that the last factor involved here is corporate profits. Most economic studies will overwhelmingly show that when a government regulation imposes a new cost on industry, approximately half of that is passed on directly to consumers in the form of higher prices. About another 40% tends to get passed back to that industry's labor force in the form of lower wages. And at the outside, maybe 10% is involved in a reduction of shareholder dividends or corporate profits. However, the real reason industry opposes this is not a question of who's going to pay the costs and what the costs are. The real reason we oppose this is we are, again, having the verdict first and the trial later. We do not know, particularly in the case of this PM 2.5 standard, if it's the right standard, if it, in fact, is going to control the right things in the right places, if, in fact, these interpolations that have been made irrespective of changes in weather pattern. For instance, the statistical correlation evaporates if you disaggregate the data and look at it on a seasonal basis. The statistical correlation is very strong if you look at the data on a gross annual basis.
You're not quibbling, again, you're not quibbling with the ozone standard then?
Well, the ozone standard, you know, actually has a different problem. The ozone standard is not the one the EPA is claiming is going to save $50 to $100 billion a year. The actual quantifiable cost saving on ozone are probably pretty low because, A, there's no mortality increase with ozone. You're talking about temporary increases in respiratory problems, which dissipate in a matter of days in most cases. So you can't make these outrageous claims that it's going to save $50 or $100 billion because you can't claim that 20,000 or 40,000 or 60,000 people are dying because of ozone-related problems because it's clearly not true. The evidence is not there.
Ira, if I might just respond to that. First of all, the numbers that I shared and the numbers that are available in the Federal Register and over our internet program are the combined cost and the combined benefits of strengthening two standards, not just one standard. And this is important. One of the things that industry has rightfully pointed out over the years is that one year they're told to do one thing and the next year they're told to do something else. So here EPA is taking that message, is hearing what industry has said, okay, and responding by saying, okay, let's do them together. Therefore, you only have to make one round of adjustments, one round of improvements to a facility, and you can meet two tougher standards. So I think, you know, the agency deserves some credit from industry for sort of reinventing how we go about articulating and developing programs to reduce air pollution. But, you know, what troubles me in this debate, and no one has quite said it, so let me go ahead and say it, is the suggestion that somehow or another the American public has to choose between a healthy economy and a healthy environment. You know, we had that debate 4 or 5 years ago, and what the public clearly said is they want both. And I think what this president, what this administration has proven is that, in fact, you can have both. In the last 4 years, EPA, working with industry, has been able to achieve the single largest reduction in toxic air emissions in the history of this country. At the same time, we have seen the economy grow at unprecedented rates. The American public do not have to choose. If industry will work in partnership with citizens, with government, we can find common sense, cost-effective ways to reduce air pollution and allow the public to breathe cleaner air.
1-800-9.
Well, I would agree with everything Administrator Browner has said. I would only disagree with the fact that this regulation or this proposed regulation will not achieve that. We subscribe wholeheartedly to the theory that you can have both a healthier environment and a healthier economy simultaneously if you do things right. Our quarrel with this particular proposal is they haven't done it right. They've jumped to conclusions. They have not adequately isolated what is causing this statistical correlation and increased mortality, and that's our problem with it.
Yeah,
we don't quarrel with the general proposition that, A, you should be willing to spend some money to have a healthier environment, and we don't quarrel with the proposition that if done right, you can have both a robust economy and a cleaner environment. We just particularly disagree with this particular procedure.
All right, let's go to Edward in Holland. Is it Michigan? Hi, Edward.
Yes, Holland, Michigan. Where we live, the prevailing winds are from the west and the southwest, and I think most scientific studies that I've read determined that most of the pollution came from Milwaukee and the Chicago area, and we were under the threat of emission testing with our cars, and I don't know whether it was based on the scientific evidence, but Ms. Browner, we were thankful for this, exempted us from this emission testing. Subsequently, the state of Michigan sold off millions of dollars of testing centers and testing instruments, and now it looks as if we're going to be under the gun again. Now, if we are going to have testing again, I think it should be based on hard science, and it shouldn't be just on the basis of politically carte blanche cover everybody. And I don't think anybody wants to pay for other people's pollution. If we, in fact, are polluting in West Michigan and the standards are determined, then I don't think people would mind so much paying for that.
So you're upset that the stuff coming into Michigan, maybe from Chicago or wherever it's coming from, may be giving you the pollution that you don't even make and you're going to have to pay for.
Right.
And I guess that's true of a lot of the Midwest. The claims for the East Coast here is that a lot of the pollution comes across the country from the Midwest and dirties the air in the East. Why should people in the East have to pay for cleaning up the air that comes from someplace else?
Well,
Ira, in fact, if I might just respond to Edward, one of the things that we are taking public comment on in this proposal is that very issue, which is looking at and better understanding how pollution, in fact, moves. And we've learned a lot in the last 20 years. And when we began the efforts under the current law, the law passed by Congress in 1990, a lot of it was very locally focused, and we didn't have the ability, quite frankly, to take into account the migration of pollution, if you will. And what we are proposing as part of strengthening the public health standards is greater ability to say, hey, where is this stuff really coming from? And what is the best way to reduce it at its source?
Okay, Edward?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks for calling. We're talking about the EPA's new proposed clean air standards that are going to be talked about a lot in the coming year, and especially when the new year rolls around and everybody is in place in Washington on Talk of the Nation from National Public Radio. What happens now with the standard in terms of politically and government? It gets proposed, and then the comment period is open till when? Is it June?
No, there is a 60-day comment period. The clock has begun running, and again, we've had many mechanisms available for the public to let their views be known. When we complete the 60-day comment period, then EPA will analyze all of the comments received. Anyone's willing, anyone who wants to, can come in and look at them with us, and then we will make a final decision by the middle part of June. Once we make that decision. That decision then is presented to Congress under a new requirement, and they will review it, and they can either reject it or accept it or say nothing about it. This is a new procedure. No one quite knows how it will play out. But I'll tell you something, Ira. We welcome this congressional review. This is a law passed by Congress. It is their mandate of every five-year review, at least every five-year review of current available scientific data that we are taking seriously, and we look forward to their review of what we found in that science and what conclusions we drew in terms of protecting the American people.
And Ira, if I could add,
yes, David.
I mean, what Carol Browner has been saying is, of course, absolutely right, that she, in fact, is bound by the Clean Air Act to consider only the science. She is not allowed to consider the cost-benefit analysis, despite the fact that, as she claims, the benefits will outweigh the costs. Even if that were not true, she is not allowed to take that into account. She's only supposed to base this standard on the science. Now, I think at some point that could be a problem, because as the air gets cleaner and cleaner and we find out that there still remain a small number of people who are harmed by even tiny amounts of pollution, we as a society are going to have to confront the fact of how much, when is clean
yeah.
enough?
Let me bring John from Edgewater, Ohio in, because I think that's what he wants to talk about. John?
I have a couple of comments related to EPA and then a couple of questions about what we can do about the air. I live at the edge of Cleveland, and we have some of the dirtiest air in Ohio here. One is that EPA only is required to look at the criteria standards of what's in the air, and they only look at six factors, one of which is particulates. When I talked to the head of the EPA labs from Triangle Park at the dioxin hearings, I asked, are we ever going to look at what's in particulates? Solids, liquids, and gases cling to these very fine particles. I've been to the hospital many times with asthma in the back of an ambulance and spent Christmas there, and I know the cost of being affected by what's in the air. One of my hospital bills exceeded my annual salary, and I'm quite concerned because I work with the Lung Association and the Remedial Action Plan that's trying to clean up the water in this part of the world, as well as the Sierra Club monitoring air. I know we don't know what's in the air. I'm concerned that when EPA was told by Congress to set standards and regulations, they didn't do it, and Sierra had to sue them. I think they're still behind in terms of setting standards under the 1990 Act. We don't have rules and regulations regarding the air, and we don't know what's in particulates. Ozone does affect us, because it's partly produced by the coal-fired generators, and they're toxic NOx-producing pollutants, which both affect our air and our health, and we've never factored in the cost of health.
Well, are you saying that if we really don't know what's in the particulates, we should
analyze them?
But should we wait until we analyze them?
No, we should analyze them now. The way it is.
And what do we do in the meantime?
Well, in the meantime, we're collecting them every day and we weigh them. We say only this is how much is there. We don't know what's in them. Mm-hmm. EPA knows that it will be very expensive to analyze what's in those particles, but those particles are many of the thousands of chemicals put out by industry that also affects industry's workers who are part of the political outlook.
Let me get a reaction. Carol Browner?
Well, first of all, I think to suggest that somehow or another EPA is not doing its part under the Clean Air Act is to ignore the record of EPA over a long period of time. And as I said earlier, I think EPA deserves a lot of the credit for the improvements we've seen thus far in our air quality in this country. It is because EPA has put in place the programs, it is because EPA has adopted tough standards that we've achieved the kind of reductions and we've made the kind of progress. I think what's important to remember here is that since the inception of the Clean Air Act more than 20 years ago, reaffirmed by George Bush 7 years ago, there is a clear requirement that EPA set a public health standard. And that is what we are asking the public to comment on here. If people disagree with a legal requirement, with a congressional mandate of public health, then their disagreement is with the United States Congress. I think it is important that our environmental laws, our public health laws, speak to the public health problems of the country and require that our population, our children, our seniors be protected.
Paul Heward, last word.
Well, I think that Administrator Browner is 100% correct when she says that EPA is merely complying with the congressional directive. What she is omitting to mention is that under the operative executive orders that control EPA and other agencies, one of the options that EPA clearly has and clearly, in our judgment, should have exercised here is the option to continue the existing standards on the ground that there was insufficient evidence, as the prior caller just indicated, of what it is they were trying to regulate and what it is that was causing the problem to justify a new, massive, expensive standard.
All right.
They could have proposed continuation of the existing standard until they had better data and better scientific analysis of what it is they wanted to regulate instead of this wholesale approach. We're just going to regulate PM2.5, even though we're not sure which parts of it are the problem. And it may not even be PM2.5, maybe nanoparticles. Who knows?
All right. That's the last bit of debate for this hour. I'd like to thank my guests. Paul Heward is the Senior Vice President for Policy and Communications at the National Association of Manufacturers in Washington. Carol Browner, the Administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. And David Barron, Science Reporter for National Public Radio. Thank you all for joining me this hour.
Thanks, Ira.
Have a good weekend. On Monday's program, join Ray for a look at the next 4 years of American foreign policy in this hour of Talk of the Nation. Rich Rary is our technical director. Our audio engineers are William O'Neill and Spider Writer, and George Edwards in New York, Cal Southworth in Washington. Thanks to computer guru Rick Jarrett, Bob Boylan composed our theme music. If you'd like to write us, please send your letters to Talk of the Nation Science Friday, WNYC Radio, 1 Center Street, New York, New York, 10007. You can email us at our internet address at scifry, that's SCIFRI, at npr.org, or surf over to the NPR webpage at www.npr.org, and you'll find us in the programming department. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.